Okay, welcome to the Sunday Special, where the hosts of the podcast On The Shack come together to talk about the week that was. I'm Vicky from Policed. I'm joined by Tony and Martin from the Echo Chamber podcast, Caroline from Glow West, and James from the Two Narries. As you all know, Lynn Dayden left The Shack this week following the sharing of racist and ableist tweets she sent in 2013 and 2014. Concerns have also emerged about the engagement of victims with the Victims Alliance. While we each host individual podcasts, we see The Shack very much as a community, and we see our subscribers as part of that community. We've come together during the week and discussed this, and we are very clear that we really need to respond to what's happened as we would had it happened on any platform. The contents of the tweets that have been shared by Linda are racist, ableist, and entirely unacceptable. We have seen concerns raised about Linda's work with the Victims Alliance, and that can also be problematic. But on that point, in the interest of natural justice, we can't comment any further. However, we will support any process that is put in place to get to the truth about the concerns that have been aired online, and we're willing to participate fully. All of this is the antithesis of the exact values which the Tortoise Shack strives to live by, those of inclusion, passing the mic, calling out injustice, and generally working for a better, fairer, more empathic and compassionate society. I certainly joined The Shack to live those values, to walk the walk, and we will all continue to do so. Today, we want to talk about this, as I say, if we had it happened anywhere. As ever, we have guests and we have an audience contributions. If you have questions, please pop those in the chat and we'll have time to talk at the end. We believe it's essential to hear from those communities that were affected by what was contained in the tweets. We must listen to how those people, those members of our society are feeling. We need to respect their views and their anger. We've tried in the last few days to create a space for that conversation to happen today, but it is too soon. It's too raw and difficult for many. Things like the funeral of Georgianchenko took place yesterday, the anniversary of COVID, and it's just generally been a really trying week. So that specific conversation can't happen today. And in the spirit of nothing about us without us, we will wait until people from those communities are ready to speak to us before discussing the tweets. We will be here, be ready to listen, and we're determined to hold that conversation as soon as we can. We can, however, have other conversations connected to the issues. Is John here, Tony?
No, I just, unfortunately, guys, I spoke this morning to John Amici, the psychologist, around the subject, and he is working and he was hoping that he could drop in. I have a message here saying he's hoping to join us. And unfortunately, okay, at this stage, he hasn't arrived. John has been on previously and he speaks about the idea of not, you know, it's about moving beyond I'm not a racist into active anti-racism and how that will work. And that conversation, he will certainly join us and I'll be delighted to do it. And I've also received a message, by the way, from Ijiro Ogbevian, who was brilliant, the psychotherapist, who will hope to join us in the coming days as well. She was as well... She was deeply impacted by the killing of Georgianchenko, and she just felt today was too soon for her. But we will certainly be returning to both, if not today with John, certainly in the near future.
Okay, so hopefully we'll get to speak to John a little later. We are joined by Cliona. I don't know if you want to upgrade Cliona there, Tony. So one of the themes that did arise this week was how victims, particularly of sexual violence, are supported and assisted. We're really delighted to be joined by Dr. Cliona Sadlier, who's director of the Rape Crisis Network of Ireland, who was also one of those who presented at the Citizens Assembly on gender-based violence this weekend. And she's agreed to come on and chat to us about this issue. So thanks very much for joining us, Cliona.
Hi, how are you? Thanks very much for inviting me on. It's really welcome to be able to address these issues. And without talking about any individual or any individual organisation, that behaviour, just really talk in general about what we would sort of consider best practice and safe practice, particularly where we're talking about online activism.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that I think come up from this week. Obviously, one of the things was about victims wanting support and engagement through online spaces and, you know, wanting to have that space to connect to others and to be able to access support and assistance. How can victims engage in that safely in the online space?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible the change that's happened with social media and, if you like, the democratization of voice that's happened over the last number of years. And it's incredibly powerful, the awareness raising and the power that survivors have and can get and feel empowered and active within that space, because everyone has the opportunity to engage. So this, and every single one of those voices is important and precious, you know, that's the first thing to say. And it's been incredibly, you know, just part of, you know, because this is a movement, you know, for change, and every single voice really adds to that. So that's the very first thing. But the question then of, well, what is it and how do we do that safely? And are there risks? I mean, that's the follow on question from that. Like the traditional organisations like ourselves, like Rape Crisis Centres and, you know, the RCNI, you know, we're not necessarily offering that same space in terms of that being able to engage publicly on social media in your own right and with your own voice. So this, I mean, I think this, you know, it's important that we value that and that we understand how that really helps the work and the movement and contributes to the movement. There is also, I mean, one of the things that is really alive to us as well in this shift is that, and do interrupt me, sorry, I do talk too much, but one of the things that's really alive to us is that not every survivor speaks out, not every survivor chooses to speak out, not every survivor chooses to go on social media or to actually name themselves and to give up their own anonymity. And we're really conscious that every survivor makes their own decision around that and makes their own choice around that. And every survivor has their own context and their own life to consider there. And they are the best judges of whether or not they speak out, whether or not they engage, whether or not they report. And really nobody else has any role whatsoever in judging that. So we're really conscious of there not being a hierarchy, if you like, around survivor's activism, because the survivor who chooses not to report may be making the bravest decision of all. We don't know. We can't judge that. We're not in their lives. So there's that aspect to it as well. So then I suppose we move into, well, what's, you know, as people engage online, sometimes they don't tell their personal story. Sometimes they're simply engaging and being activists in the subject generally. And that's, you know, really opening up a conversation about the different aspects around sexual violence, around misogyny, around sexism, and around all of the way that these things interact. And that's, if you like, a fairly safe thing to do because you're not exposing yourself personally. Mm. But then I suppose if we are talking then about people reaching out, telling their own stories, but also reaching out to other people in terms of their experience of victimization, then we get into risk, I suppose. I think I'd put it down to two things that I would say just in general terms to be mindful of in that space. Or maybe three things. I mean, the first thing is as a survivor, what do you want to get out of speaking publicly? What is it you're expecting from this? And really, that hasn't changed with social media. That's, the question has always been there in terms of survivors going public. I've been working with survivors going public for 17 years now. And the first question I ask them is, what do you want? What are you looking for? And very often a survivor is saying, well, I want justice. And actually my job is, you're not going to get justice on social media. You're not going to get justice. It's not, you know, you're going to get something different, but you're not necessarily, for example, going to get your case reopened. That's not how a criminal justice system works. You're not necessarily going to get something from the minister. That's not how it works. So really it's teasing through what is it you're trying to achieve? And is telling your story publicly the right tool? Because sometimes it's not. Sometimes there's not a match there. So that's a really important piece, just so people know and are making the choice, they're fully informed about that choice. And then the second thing is, you know, the public space is not necessarily, if you're looking for justice, for example, if you're looking for formal justice, your evidence is, you know, the processes of justice, and Vicky, you can come in here, the processes of justice are very particular. We should never be sharing our evidence in public spaces. The only people who should be getting our evidence is the Gardaí, yeah, the authority that we have invested in terms of our state. So if you're being asked to put your evidence out there, if you're putting your evidence out there, or anyone else is asking you for your evidence, I would say that would be a bit of a red flag for you. The only people you should be handing your evidence to is the Garda Síochána.
And of course, that is really frustrating because a lot of victims have had very difficult experiences with the Gardaí, and that trust isn't always there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, the conviction rates are low if we take it right from the top all the way through. And obviously, we're doing a lot of work. And of course, you were on the policing authority, Vicky. So it's, you know, the work that is done to improve the system, you know, we continue with that work, and that work will continue. But it doesn't work for everyone. The criminal justice system at the end of the day only works for a small portion of people. And in fact, sometimes, you know, we think of it as it sets an example as opposed to delivers justice to every individual. And almost like that example becomes the justice that we all get in terms of how the state sends its signal that this is a crime and this will be punished, because not every...
And there are, like, we can kind of draw distinctions there, can't we, between, like, there are different things that victims need, and that will vary depending on the victim, but, like, that concept of what the state and the justice system gives them. But then in addition to that, the supports that they're provided. So who is there keeping them informed, going to Garda stations, you know, helping them with that process, giving them counselling, all the different things that they need. What gaps are there in terms of what supports the state is providing victims?
So there's been huge change around this. And I suppose fundamentally we've moved from thinking about justice for victims as being simply a conviction at the end of the day, because that's a very small proportion of people. We think of justice as every single step that happens along the way, whether you choose to report or not formally. So, you know, it's about how you are treated, the respect and dignity you're treated with, the you know, that you are heard, and that you are believed in that, and that you are treated with respect and with a full and complete and comprehensive response at every step. So that's critically important. And that has really changed in terms of how we value and measure how, you know, because the service we deliver is every single stage of it. Because survivors, you know, they do understand that we have a constitutional defence, you know, due process and really high standards before we put someone in prison and convict someone. They understand that their case might not necessarily get to that point, but they do want to be treated with respect and dignity all the way through and with the full investigation that they're entitled to because they were wronged. So that's important. We would have, and what's possibly not so well known is, We would do in rape crisis, we would do court and Garda accompaniment. So if you're going to the Guards, if you're going to court, or if you're thinking about going to the Guards or the court, please come and talk to your local rape crisis centre, because we have trained volunteers and staff who can really accompany you there, who know your rights as you go through that system, who know what you can ask for at every stage, and who know what you're entitled to at every stage, and will be your emotional support all the way through. So, you know, as I say, it's that's there for every victim going through that system, the court and Garda accompaniment service that we would offer. And as I say, any rape crisis centre, just contact your local rape crisis centre around that.
Caroline, do you want to come in there?
Yeah, I suppose with Rape Crisis Centre, there's a lot of criticism of it recently for platforming a very well-known transphobe, and a lot of people saying that, you know, trans people aren't going to feel safe accessing the service. And I thought that a lot of those comments were just ignored by the Rape Crisis Centre and weren't really engaged with it. And I think that's really problematic, and that needs to be called out as well. If we're talking about, you know, being open to all victims, you know, trans people are a high risk of sexual violence. But, you know, if organisations are platforming trans people, then that's not creating a friendly environment for people to come forward to when they need support.
So Rape Crisis Centres have been providing services for trans people for decades. Trans people have been coming to us for decades and are with us today in terms of receiving support, because, as you say, they experience sexual violence, and they experience sexual violence not only in general terms, but because they are targeted specifically because they are trans and gender non-conforming. So that's something that we're really we've been working on. We're really proud of that, you know, Rape Crisis Centres are accessible and are trusted by the trans community in delivering that service. We continued, in fact, the last time we looked at our process and policies around this was about 5 years ago, which obviously times moved very fast, so that's quite dated now. But we looked at all of our data and we produced the LGBT statistics around the particular vulnerabilities of LGBT people who were coming to rape crisis centres. And that was a really important piece of work for us. And we spent quite some time engaging and talking with LGBT organisations, including Tenny, and really just looking at how we engage and what our systems and processes are. Again, we're looking at our clinical, what we deliver clinically at the moment, and it's a big piece of work for us. We think it's essential housekeeping to continually do that work, to continue to look at what we're delivering and how we're delivering it, and if it is fit for purpose. The consultant, that the external consultant on that project, is well renowned in the area of sexual violence, in terms of victim blaming, in terms of the survivor-centered approach to sexual violence, which aligns very much with what Rape Crisis aims to do, has always historically aimed to do, to be survivor-centered in terms of how we approach the issue of sexual violence, as opposed to, I suppose, individualized in terms of a psychological approach to sexual violence and sexual violence counseling. So that is the, and she is outstanding in her field around it. So that is why she's part of that project in terms of,
I mean, like, she is,
she's got the most recent research as well around victim
she's
blaming.
She's done incredible work and absolutely can't deny that. Like, she's done absolutely amazing work, but like, the fact that lots of trans people came forward and said, here's all the screenshots of her comments about trans people, and were ignored and felt that they didn't receive a response.
One of the things that is, we have, and this gets into, I suppose, and I don't want to talk about what, you know, I think we should leave it to Vicky to, and the rest of you, in terms of the decision you made about what happened this week. But this is gets into the issue of, I suppose, cancel culture and how we engage in this space around issues like this. Certainly for ourselves, we don't engage in cancel culture. That is a policy decision around how we engage with that kind of, if you like, pile on and cancel culture, what we might call cancel culture. And I don't know if anyone else has thoughts on that and how that process works, if you like, in terms of the online space. And what is the right approach around that? For us, very much when we looked at those aspects, I think we did see the comments, not all of them. And in the UK, as you know, this conversation is much more. I don't even know what the right word is. It's bigger. Much more toxic, frankly. Over there, she is not considered a transphobe. That label has never stuck. So for us, that was in many ways, we kind of looked at that and went, well, you know, where somewhere where it's much more vitriolic than over here, that label has never stuck. So I would say that it isn't a decided thing. And we certainly were looking, we weren't looking for the skill set we were looking for was, as you say, was her excellence in this field. And the very fact that as I say, that label hasn't struck and she has worked with that population.
There's clearly really strong sentiment among the audience as well in relation to this issue. And so I think probably something best come back to in its own right on another occasion. Was there anything, we're moving on, we're staying with gender-based violence, but we do have to move on in a second. Was there anything further you wanted to say around the supports that victims require?
Well, I suppose in terms of supports, it was more I wanted to talk about the how we engage safely and what the overarching rules around engaging safely in terms of activism and supporting survivors and reaching out to survivors. And the first one is the question of evidence, which I've already talked about. Mm-hmm. The second one is this question that isn't just about online activism. We've learned it generally, which is around when we move to DMs, when we move to you know, in real life, when we move from someone we've met or engaged with on social media into a direct engagement that is offline in some way or private in some way. And I think we all know already what the safety measures we should be putting up around that are, and we probably engage in them, and we have a set of rules already established around that in terms of how we move into that space. But I suppose in particular that we should be extra cautious around that type of issue when we're targeting vulnerable people. So when we're inviting, when we're reaching out to and inviting and setting ourselves up to invite vulnerable people to contact us directly around their vulnerability, and we're moving that to a private space, particularly if we're a private individual, particularly if we're not connected with an organisation, particularly if we're not therefore accountable to very public processes and structures. So I think that's the other one is like when we're, you know, just like any other landscape, when we move to DMs, we need to be really careful about that.
Okay. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. We have, as I say, we're going to keep with the theme of gender-based violence and looking what's been happening in England this week. So I think, Caroline, you were going to talk to Dawn about that.
I was, but to be honest, I wanted to go back actually to the start of the podcast because I was under the impression that we were all going to chip in at the start and talk about.
I think we just felt because we didn't have the broad community, it would be difficult to do that. But of course.
Yeah, no, just to, you know, and it reflected, there's quite a few comments coming in there of, you know, like, that's great that we put what you said this morning, you know, absolutely. But obviously the feeling is there that that should have gone out a few days ago. And, you know, not to throw you under the bus, Tony, but I think if that statement that Vicky read out today had it gone out on Thursday or Friday.
Hang on, Carolyn, I had to get a communications expert to read through this to make sure it was right. I'm a one man show. I get it, but I put it out
though, and
I, yeah, go ahead. But
I just felt that making a statement saying there's no further comment when we had all decided that we were going to talk about it today, and talk about it in a bit more detail, felt that it was being read as we're not talking about this. And the plan was always to talk about it because, like, we all met and we all discussed and we all said that we were going to be open about this and we're not going to ignore the fact that this had happened or try and undermine it or whatever. We're going to call it out. So I just felt that if we had it talked a little bit more and said, yeah, we're going to discuss this on Sunday, I think that would kind of maybe minimize some of the harm that's been done and some of the anger that's been there. And I think there's a lot of justifiable anger, of course, for a lot of reasons. But I just felt if it was spoken about by us that said, look, we will talk about this on Sunday in more detail rather than we're not going to make any further comments, I think that's led people to.
But we did put out a thing saying that we would speak on it on
Sunday. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I did. And I put it out, and I put it out publicly, and I put it out on Patreon.
To be fair, the initial piece was just about conveying
that Linda
was leaving.
Yeah. Yeah,
that was all that was about.
Yeah,
and we very clearly and quickly advertised the Sunday special because we had, and just to explain this to people listening, we had come together and we had all agreed that there was nothing that could be done in a statement. This needed to be a conversation. We wanted this to be us talking directly to you in this forum. We, like, all of us instantly said, Sunday is the time to talk about this because that's where we meet with you. That's where we engage with our community of listeners. And I do think, you know, the decision for Linda to leave had to be, you know, was, and she wanted that conveyed quite immediately. And so that was done. And Tony said he wasn't commenting on her decision any further. And then we very quickly said we were speaking about it on Sunday. So, like, you know, I do think in very difficult circumstances where there was immense hurt caused, and there is zero doubt about that. And, you know, the very fact we have tried really hard to pull a panel of people together today, and people are hurting, and, you know, we couldn't do that today. Like, you can't deal with everything as quick as you'd like. It's not always possible.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely. No, that's fine. I think would it be nice to be consulted on what
we
was.
Were. We have a meeting.
Yeah, but I didn't know what you were going to say this morning. I thought we were all going to come to it and we're all going to say our pieces on it. And then we kind of moved straight over to Cliona there. So I just think our own communication there needs to kind of be brought up. But I just think there's a lot of fair points about
it. It's all there in the WhatsApp.
I thought we were going to all, you know, you were going to open
it's it. All there all in the WhatsApp that we couldn't do that.
Does it look, because we didn't have them. I accept. And I accept that there were shortcomings in what I did. Absolutely. I've apologized for them and I've apologized to all of you. But I was trying to make sure that we didn't let it fester any longer than we had to. And then we would get something done correctly and through proper channels. I mean, I did actually try and engage with people who know about these things and get it done properly. And, you know, like there's questions now. Absolutely, that's fair. It was badly communicated. But at the same time, you know, this is like I didn't. There's accusations that I didn't do due diligence and this sort of stuff. The idea, I think, is quite mad that I'd go back 10 years someone's tweets of 10 years and the idea that, and there's questions, you know, around a contract to the Tortoise Shack. The individuals who contribute, they own their IP, their intellectual property. This is a hub and a platform. And I'm glad that people are like passionate and challenging to do better, because I know I've learned a lot and like but at the same time, I do feel that there's an element of, this was the platform that we agreed we tried to do it on. This is the forum we've used for the last 30 weeks. So this is probably the best forum to have that conversation.
I think there's just one comment there that kind of sums up my feeling of it. I think the phrasing of the original Twitter statement was regrettable. To me, it read as though it was going to be the last comment by the Tortoise Shack on the subject. And that was never going to be the case.
No,
it was never going to be a one and done. But I can understand how people would have read it like that. And I think that's the regrettable part of this.
It's the part where I said, what I meant by that was, ultimately, is because I knew it was going to be replies below the tweet. Absolutely. And I said, I'm not going to engage with that. I'm going to mute it because I got to get on with other things. And then the second part of it is, it wasn't unequivocal enough at the outset. Again, that's my problem. That's my error. That's not on anybody else's shoulders. That's on mine. And I'll own that and move forward. But I feel guilty enough about the whole situation. And I just want people to understand that, yeah, imperfect as it was, you know, it was an imperfect situation. And ultimately trying to balance empathy, sympathy, critical thinking, and doing the right thing, and I screwed up. That's all I can really say on that.
But look, that's fine. It's just like, to name that, you know, I didn't know how to respond to this. I was like, what do I do? What do I say? But I think just like we have that time to reflect of going, maybe other things could have been done. I know like the Soc Dems have put out a statement and that wasn't good enough either. And that's, you know, I think all these things of when we're calling people out and how we do them causes further harm to the people who've been affected by that. And I think it's just trying to figure out ways to do this that aren't going to contribute more trauma on top of trauma, I think. So I just like, and for us to express our own anger and stuff as well, I thought we would just have that moment today to all kind of come across. Maybe I've read a WhatsApp message wrong, but
yeah, I think the concern there was simply if we didn't have members of affected communities, for us to have that discussion is us talking about them without them, you know. I didn't feel that was what we wanted to do. Okay, I hope people can hear at a minimum we're all reflecting very deeply on this, and we are thinking and trying to have the conversations that need to be had. And this is really difficult. And one of the aims of today was not only to name it, to call it out, because it has to be called out. You know, the tweets were utterly unacceptable. And we are, you know, we're hurt by them and we can't even begin to imagine what that feels like to the affected communities. And we will have that conversation as soon as people are ready to come to us to have that conversation. And we respect that decision of theirs entirely. And we do, you know, we will do the work that it takes to ensure that those people that we have fought so hard to include on our platform continue to feel included. When we talked about if we were doing this, if this had happened on another platform, how would we do it? We talked about naming it, that was really, really important. But that always the emphasis in the Shack was to push it forward and have those conversations. So that's why we wanted to have a conversation. OK, what does it really mean to be an active ally? What does that look like? What do you do? Is why we wanted to have the conversation about what supports do victims of sexual violence need and what do we do? So that's what we were aiming to do this morning. It hasn't gone as we'd hoped, both in terms of accessing guests, but also just the anger that's there, very understandably, is interfering with that. I don't know, do we want to do things a little bit differently and open this up a little bit now, or will we continue to the conversation?
Yeah, the only thing I will say is again, I've apologized for letting people down, and I've apologized for letting you guys down, and I need to apologize to Caroline because your hurt is every bit more is valid, and that's just fair. So unfortunately, that's all I can say on that. I'm totally understand why you'd be down about it. So apologies.
It's fine. Look, it's just like, you know, we can't sit back and not name this and look at this on our own platform and stuff. And God, like the thoughts I was stressed with coming on today, because I was like, what am I going to say? Am I going to say something else that's going to put my foot in it, that's going to cause more harm to other people? And I knew I had to call you for the statement. And I was like, oh my God, like I haven't got a Xanax today. I'm in dire, like I'm off sick for work with anxiety at the moment, and this is not helping. But it doesn't matter. Like none of that matters. It just needs to be called out. And like, you know, and just... like sometimes it's just as easy as saying we fucked up. Like that's it. Like that's, you know, but that's it. Not making excuses. Just like we're all learning, but just saying we fucked up. You know, and like, yeah. Oh, there's lots more I could say there, but conscious that there's a lot of learning to be done by everybody, you know, and there's a lot of listening to do. And I just hate the fact that there's so much upset that I've seen on Twitter and people turning against each other and people deactivating and things like this, because it's just gone on and it's just become really, really nasty. And you've seen like former friends, you know, like certain fights and stuff with each other, and it's just like, what a mess. Like it's awful. And yeah, it's hard to know what to do, you know, but like someone just said there, I don't envy Tony's position. Yeah, I don't. Like, I don't envy Tony. And, you know, we've been on the phone a lot since this has all happened. And it's shit. It's just shit. You know, and like, yeah, it's just shit.
Yeah, no, it's like watching your own autopsy, to be honest with you. And knowing that, you know, and you could have done better, but watching them being picked apart anyway.
But also the fact that our own autopsy is the side issue.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, you can't talk about it. Anyway. Yeah.
But I just mean like what we want to do and what the conversations we did have, and maybe we didn't discuss everything properly, and I totally accept that. But the conversations that were had, we were very clear on how to go forward with this as a Shack. Have the conversations, hear from people about what was said and why it hurt them and how they're feeling and how we need to respond in order to heal those wounds, to restore trust and faith in us as a community, but also to be the active allies that we commit ourselves to being. And that's, I think we can say that's the priority on all of the Shack's mind, is to have that conversation. It couldn't happen today. And that's totally fair enough. We will do it when people are ready. So eye on the prize, like that's our goal, to have that conversation. I don't know if Martin or James want to comment on any of that.
I'd come in there, Martin, if you don't mind, just briefly. I really feel bad for Tony here, because I think that the talk of the Shack is a collective, but Tony is left the answer for everything, you know. So I'm new to the Talk the Shack. I'm the newest member, and I'm not used to this type of a thing. So I've been kind of, I suppose, trying to keep a low profile, because like Caroline said, I didn't want to make things worse, and I'm not so familiar with these circumstances. But at the same time, I am married to a traveller person. My in-laws are travellers, they're great people. I've seen comments about junkies and, you know, these type of things. When I'm in recovery, I advocate for people in addiction and homelessness, and to be associated with the Talk to Shack is an honor for me. I was delighted Tony asked me to come on because I was a fan, and to have the be associated them with those comments afterwards, it was like, how does that happen? You know what I mean? It was the irony of it, you know, and everything we stand for is everything we're against, I suppose, was in those tweets. Like, and I just it's hard to take in. It's very hard to take in. And I'd be very open to having the conversation whenever we want to have it. But I do agree that probably we need to have a conversation ourselves, and then have the conversation with the affected communities, of which I could probably participate there too. So look, it's a very tough situation. And my heart goes out to Tony especially.
James, thanks. And I've been in contact with everybody, but I've obviously not done a great job of the communication. So again,
we're not going to feel too sorry for the white
man. I'll own that. Yeah.
I do think, and I have sat back and I've tried to think about it, and I've tried to balance everything up. And I do think we rely as a group a lot on our integrity. We rely an awful lot. But anything that's happening to us is kind of a side issue. Yeah. I think the hurt that it caused to other people, and I think particularly for the victims groups, what's the best word for it? I just really feel for people out there who are looking for a space that they want to be safe.
Yeah.
And that now there's just, it's become so toxic. And I really do think that there's a lot of people let down there. I really do. And I do in some way feel responsible for it. I know, you know, this is the Tortoise Shack. This is our platform. I kind of echo what Tony says. We don't go back through people's tweets, and we greet people on face value, and we like to trust people, and we do, and that's part of what we do. But I think our hurt is very secondary to what other people are feeling. And yeah, we do need to have the conversation. And for me, like, I'm a 50 something year old man, these are conversations that are difficult, but they're also conversations that are really, really necessary, and I think we do have to have them. But I think the point that Vicky has made, that we don't want to be hasty about having the conversations, I think that's right too. I think we have to do it properly when we address it. That's what we try and do in the Tortoise Shack. We try and take the full picture and give everybody their platform, pull up the chair, let people speak. So I can just say, look, I'm disappointed. I'm disappointed that it happened. I feel hurt. I feel hurt for everybody on the shack, and I do feel hurt for Tony. Tony gets a lot of stick, but I'm kind of like that silent partner, you know. And he does get an awful lot of stick.
Pointing them at me usually.
No, he does get an awful lot of stick, and it, you know, it is a lonely place, and it is a lonely place. And I also think too, and I'm very conscious of this, it is also a very lonely place for Linda. And I am conscious of that too. And I wouldn't like to see, you know, we've seen scenarios like this before, and there is no easy way out. There is no easy way out of this. And it's a difficult, difficult conversation. It's a difficult way. We're going to have to talk to ourselves, talk to each other about it, and talk to the people that rely on us about it as well. And that's really what I have to say. I still haven't, come to terms with it, and I really haven't.
Yeah, there's a lot of, not only conversations, but there's a lot of listening to be done, an awful lot of listening, and to hear what's needed. And there's an awful lot of comments coming in. And it's interesting to see the different views. Like, I think some people seem a little, you know, relieved in a way to see that we're having this conversation. Other people saying, like, we need to move on and step up. And, you know, I can't find now Lynn Rowan's comment.
I do see a comment there saying that, you know, people benefit financially from coming on the track. Can I just, you know, we don't benefit financially. Let's just knock that one on the head straight away. No, we don't. Yeah. we do this because it is our passion to do this.
Yeah.
That's why we do it.
Like, there was a comment earlier about the mixing between friendships and work. Like, for me, this isn't work. I don't get a penny from this. This is something I do because I believe in it. And that's why I do it. And if it actually became a formalized thing where there was policies or even contracts, I'd actually have real difficulty with that, because that's not what I'm here for. I already have a job, you know.
I do. Actually, I found Lynn's message, and maybe less internal dialogues in terms of what you didn't and did not do, and maybe more about, sorry, but now it's jumping now because everybody's, the comments are flying. Conversations on the problem with us, white women and people discuss more privilege buffering appear from the brunt of racism, classism. And I think that's really fair. Lynn made a really good point on Twitter about the difference between confusing the empathy with loyalty. And again, yeah, I think that's very fair. And I think that's something that we can certainly do better at.
I had a conversation with somebody during the week, because I have been trying to like read up about all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, that difference between calling in and calling out, and how we have to, people who have a public platform and who have used that in certain ways, we do have to call that out. And then there's the difficult part among friends about calling in. And I think that's something that people have been struggling with this week, is like, we have to be upfront about it. We're all concerned about Linda, you know, like, and we shouldn't lie about that. We do have a concern about the impact all of this is having on with her. And then we have to wrestle with the difficulty of accepting what was said and how she said it. And so I think we are all doing our best to reflect and learn and figure out how to deal with this going forward. I think that's something that's going to continue over the coming weeks. And I suppose all we can do is our best to assure you, particularly our Patreons, those who subscribe and support us, that we will continue to reflect and have those conversations and do our best to listen. I feel a bit awkward doing it, but I would like to move to, there's been some really important events in the UK this week, not disconnected from this issue, because they are about gender-based violence. They are about the power of the state and what's been done. And Dawn has been sitting very patiently while we had that discussion. But I think it's a really important discussion to move to. So Caroline, would you like to introduce this topic?
Clear my throat there. Obviously, this is the news over in the UK that a woman was murdered by a serving police officer. Allegedly, I'm not sure if he's 100% charged yet, but has definitely been brought in for question of it, which has led to a lot of comments about she was walking home late at night, and some people saying, well, what did you expect? And the answer is she expected to make it home okay and safe. That's what she expected. So it's also been a conversation about women's safety, victim blaming, what men can do to be better. And then Davina McCall somehow getting into all this and saying, don't be given out to men. What about their mental health? Which is obviously, like, that's not the only time you can bring up men's mental health in relation to women saying, I don't feel safe walking the street. So it's been a pretty traumatic week for a lot of it. You know, there's images of women going, here, you have to hold your keys in between your fingers like this. And other women saying, no, that will actually hurt your hands. You have to hold a key like this, or you have to have mace. And it's like, you should just actually be able to walk home. And lots of conversations from men learning about, oh, I didn't know that a lot of women in the wintertime don't go out after 4 o'clock. I go out for a run. What's the problem? And like oblivious nature to that. But then I suppose we've also seen as a result, criticism of how Sarah's case has been raised in the media, because she's a very pretty blonde lady, and there have been, I think it's two black women in the Met that police officers took selfies next to their bodies, and another black woman that her case just wasn't investigated. So obviously racism is never far from sexism in a lot of these cases. So there's a lot of conversations that have come up about policing, racism, misogyny, and just, can we just bloody exist in the world? So Don, I'll pass it over to you, because I'm going to go on a massive rant there, and I'll try not to, but there you go.
No, I understand entirely. yeah, it's been a really kind of traumatic week for, I think, everybody who's been following the case. And I remember walking home with one of my friends less than 48 hours after she went missing. And we walked over Clapham Common, which is also the route that she walked home. It was dark. It was 8 p.m. at night. It's always really, really busy there. It's very, very safe. And we noticed that there were sniffer dogs everywhere. So whenever I see people talking about the fact that she was walking home alone late at night, it's like, well, A, is she supposed to get a cab in the middle of COVID? And also, you know, from the stories that have emerged so far, the alleged offender actually used his police warrant card to convince her to get into his car. So, you know, it happened on a busy on a busy road, and he used allegedly the professional credentials that he had that way. I think the police realized quite quickly that this wasn't that they were unlikely to find her alive, hence the kind of very quick response. But essentially they hadn't been any good since at investigate at basically kind of looking at the response to a alleged crime by one of their own. So I live very close to Clapham Common. It's just around the corner. There was a vigil there last night, and the local police force in Lambeth were happy for it to go ahead. They were speaking to the organisers, and they said, as long as you stay about 2 metres apart, keep your masks on, we're perfectly happy for it to go ahead. And then the Metropolitan Police decided to ban it entirely. And it's the Metropolitan Police you see in all of the photos circulating of lots of different women being pinned to the ground, being arrested, etc. And the Met have a really, really terrible history. I mean, you can go back way before I was born. You can look at the Battle of Orgreave, where they, batting charged striking minors. You know, the police forces that we have in the UK have always been very, very, very violent, especially towards working class people, especially towards people of colour. And women, you know, just don't feel safe speaking to them about gender-based violence, about any sexual harassment in the street or anything like that. I mean, when I was growing up in South Wales, my stepfather was very violent, and the police were called when the neighbours would ring them occasionally when they were worried. Police never did anything, and the only time that anything actually happened was when he murdered my grandfather, and he called up the police himself and shot himself. So essentially did their work for them. And essentially now the conversation in the UK is what we do about this. So there are some people calling for Cressida Dick, who is the head of the Metropolitan Police Force, to resign. But I think you have to look at the fact that the Met as a force, you know, in both in terms of decades, but also very recently, is just completely not fit for in no way, shape or form is it fit for purpose. So, you know, you can look at the death of Ian Tomlinson. You can look at the fact that they shot John Menendez. Yeah. And instantly put out misinformation about that shooting. You can look at the fact that you know, only last month, as you mentioned, serving Met police officers took selfies with the bodies of two women of colour. And in a separate incident, a 7-year-old boy was looking on YouTube and Googled his father's name after his father had been stabbed outside a kebab shop. And some Met officers had decided to upload the CCTV footage of this man, a man of colour, just being stabbed at random outside a kebab shop because they seemingly thought it was funny. And YouTube was clearly the place for it.
And I always think in this context of, well, as well as the black taxi, the black cab rapist, where, you know, the Met had failed to investigate and they've actually, you know, were held against in a court of law, that future victims, those rapes could have been prevented had the Met actually stepped up and investigated those rapes. And there's a very worrying piece of legislation going through Parliament at the moment, isn't there, Dawn?
Yeah, there's a big policing bill that's going through Monday and Tuesday. Up until, what's the time now? Up until 2 hours ago, Labour were whipping to abstain on it until they had a big revolt amongst their more left-wing MPs. And the Conservatives are trying to rush it through. And it essentially gives the police more powers to stop protests. It essentially enshrines all of the temporary powers that they have under the COVID powers bills and puts them into permanent laws. So essentially, you know, the police force can say that you have no right to protest, you have no right to gather in a public place to protest, if the
noise might have an impact on others. It's insane. It's really insane.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, really quite terrible. And the only thing we can really hope for at the moment is for a kind of backbench rebellion from some Conservatives who've been hopefully upset by this. Or, you know, occasionally you get the odd strange libertarian Tory who is, you know, very into freedom of speech and actually understands that that is linked to protest. But we've also had the Spy Cops Bill going through Parliament, which essentially gives police forces the legal right to go undercover, form relationships with people that tend to be women. And as we've seen in the past, especially with the Met, they tended to target left-wing groups, and a lot of women, you know, were essentially raped by the state. And some of these officers had children with women in these movements. And then one day these men just disappeared and went back to their normal life.
Yeah. There are huge issues here around policing and misogyny, primarily, I suppose, just kind of keeping it with the theme of gender-based violence and the way women were being treated last night, who were so clearly peacefully protesting, is really quite apparent. I think we are kind of close to wrapping up the formal bit of this. We might have time for a very brief Q&A, will we, Tony?
I'm happy to hang on.
Yeah. Okay, so as ever, thank you all for listening and engaging, for your continued support. And we hope that through the coming weeks, we can just prove that we merit that support that you give us, and that we earn your trust as our listeners, through our actions and through our podcasts. So thank you for coming today and engaging. We will speak to you next week.